Welcome to the Snowfighters Institute podcast, featuring conversations with leaders in professional snow and ice management about what's working, what's challenging, and what matters most in our industry. Here's your host, Phil Harwood.
Welcome back, Snowfighters, to another episode of the Snowfighters Institute podcast. I'm your host, Phil Harwood, and I'm joined today by Matt Delbarello. Did I say that right, Matt?
Nailed it. Good job.
All right, good. Matt's from the Alera Group. He's a commercial insurance consultant, and so we're going to be talking about all things insurance today. He's also an accredited professional in risk and insurance, and he focuses on construction, landscaping, snow and ice contractors in the residential, commercial, and industrial space. And he works with contractors, clients ranging from anywhere from like 10 to 100 employees or probably even more, which probably covers 99% of everybody on this call. So welcome, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Phil. Excited to be here today.
Matt's also a new father with a almost 2-month-old little girl. How's that going?
Oh, it's going well. You know, the adjustment to sleep, it eventually comes. So you start to function a little bit better off of the lack of sleep. And, you know, it's a season of life. So we're enjoying it, and we know it'll soon be passed.
Yeah. Well, it's your second time through with your son, who's what, 2? Is that right?
Yeah. Our little guy's 2.5. So,
okay.
Thankfully, right. he's a wonderful sleeper. So he's given us no issues with his sleep. And so we're just managing the little one at this point.
That's great. Well, again, thank you for being here. Hopefully you got some rest last night. So, I want to kind of start big picture, kind of hearing about your company and what you guys do, just kind of big top line, big overview, and then we can kind of get down into the snow specific stuff. Maybe just talk to us about the Alera Group. Maybe someone's, you know, never heard that word before. So what is that company all about? And then we'll talk about your role in the company.
Yeah, absolutely. So Alera Group, we are a national insurance agency. We have capacity to do anything from property casualty is the actual definition, but business insurance, commercial insurance, which is what I focus on. We have an employee benefits division, which focuses on your health insurance for employees. And then we also have wealth management, retirement services. So 401k services, retirement plan services, and wealth management for clients as well, located throughout the United States. I think we have locations in like 40 out of the 48 states, and you know, up to, I think we're close to almost 5,000 employees at this point. So we have some national capacity, which is really nice. And believe it or not, our agency, our office located here in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, the Lehigh Valley portion of Pennsylvania, we were one of the founding groups of Alera Group. So they approached our agency, which was independent, when they started Alera Group back in 2017, and we got in from the ground up. And so being able to really help build it with them has been really cool. And we definitely feel the value in that.
Well, thank you for that. What a very broad scope of services. I mean, you think about all those different categories you just talked about: employee benefits, wealth management, property casualty, business. And I mean, just that's a huge, is that a unique model, or do you have competitors that are also offering all the, because to me, that seems like a very broad scope of services.
Yeah. Just to clarify with that, I do not do all of those things.
I understand.
Right. Sure. Yeah. The only thing I do is the business insurance. Mm-hmm. It's something that we're seeing a little bit more of today, you know, especially when there's a lot of M&A activity currently with the larger brokers of the insurance world. And as they get larger, they just have more and more services available. Yeah. I would say, you know, the main ones, even in your smaller regional or, you know, smaller local insurance agencies, they usually had a employee benefits, health insurance, coupled with the property and casualty side of things. The one that kind of starts to separate you a little bit, in my opinion, is when you start adding financial services, retirement plans, 401k services, things like that.
Yeah, those, that was really what caught my ear.
Yeah.
I think what's really cool here also is that you have such great reach. So pretty much anybody listening to this podcast probably has an office, a location in their state, or could be serviced, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the main reasons that we decided to be a founding member with Alera Group was the collaboration opportunity. You know, I could be talking to someone in Colorado and we have an office there, and not just that, but when it comes to licensing and all sorts of things with insurance markets, you need to have, you know, licenses and accreditations and things like that. And so by being a part of Alera Group, you know, I can talk to someone in, for example, Colorado and help them with their insurance because we have an office out in Colorado that has the licenses and the requirements in place so that we can continue to move forward with them. Mm-hmm. So it's given us a lot more reach and capacity to work with businesses, not just in, you know, the PA, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia area, but just across the, you know, entire United States.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I want to hear about what you do. And, you know, again, if we can kind of start broad and then we can work down a little bit. I think when a lot of people start having conversations about insurance, their eyes glaze over, they get lost in all the language. And it seems sometimes overly complex, and it probably is, but simplify it for us. So what are the, you know, categories when you say business insurance, what are you talking about here? And you know, walk us through that.
Yep. So business insurance involves, I'll give the main ones that we work on. So your general liability, your umbrella liability, auto insurance, workers' comp, property, inland marine or equipment insurance are the main ones that we focus. Like when I'm talking to the, you know, clients that are probably going to listen to this, or the landscapers, snow and ice contractors listening to this, those are the main coverages that we focus on. Now, obviously, there's a lot of additional insurances that we can dive into on the property and casualty side, but those are the main ones that I focus on from an insurance perspective.
Okay, so kind of you went through a list of several things. Kind of talk us through what those are. So you said G&L. So what is that?
Yep. So general liability, that's your basic insurance that if you have a business, you need general liability insurance. So that's what pays out for third-party liability claims. You know, in this instance, slip and falls primarily are the main one that everybody knows about. That's general liability insurance. It's the rating for it, meaning how they determine your premium is either based off of usually your total costs or your total sales, or your payroll, what your total payroll is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're going to get into that conversation a little bit more later, I think. And then you mentioned some other things. So can you walk through? You said, you know, everyone needs general liability insurance, of course. What are you seeing as far as coverage amounts that are required in the, I will go into the snow industry here for a minute. What are you seeing there? I'm seeing quite a range. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so when we're talking about general liability, the standard limits are $1 million per occurrence, meaning any single general liability claim up to $1 million is covered per occurrence. And then $2 million aggregate. So that means you can have two separate $1 million liability claims on your general liability policy. Now, in the snow and ice space and in the insurance world, especially when it comes to anyone in a, you know, a contracting role, today we're seeing higher liability limits required, which is where the umbrella liability that we also focus on comes into play, because that provides you additional layers of liability protection over top of your general liability, as well as your employer's liability, which is for your workers' comp, and over your auto liability. So that's where we're seeing, and that's where you'll add on additional layers of protection. You know, you can ask for higher limits on your general liability policy, like a $2 million per occurrence, $4 million aggregate limit. Mm-hmm. That's never really something that I advise, because if you do that, you're increasing your general liability pricing, which means at audit time, which general liability is an auditable line of coverage, your audit's going to be, you're going to be impacted more by the audit because your general liability is costing you more. Whereas an umbrella liability policy, that's not an auditable line. So they can't go back and say, hey, you ran more in payroll or you did more in sales this year. We're adding on to your umbrella liability policy like they can your general liability policy. You know, they can't go back and say, you owe us for the additional payroll that you ran. Mm-hmm. That's not something they can do with an umbrella policy. And so rather than telling a client or advising a client to increase their general liability limits, we'll say, hey, our advice is put in place an umbrella, raise your umbrella limits, because not only does it keep your general liability spend down, it also provides broader protection because it gives you coverage over your auto and your employer's liability as well.
Okay. So the umbrella gives higher limits, coverage amounts, but it also includes more stuff.
Yes.
than GL. Okay. All right, cool. I'm trying to keep this really simple.
Yeah.
So we don't get lost in all the lingo. What is your specific role? What's a normal week or a normal day look like for you? Are you meeting with clients? Are you doing sales work? Are you doing pricing? Or what are you doing?
Yeah. So typical week for me. So to answer your first question, I'm what they call a producer or an agent in the insurance world. So I am responsible for putting up a number inside of Alera Group. I have a goal to hit. Mm-hmm. And I hit that goal by writing new business. So calling on new accounts, you know, trying to work my current accounts that I have good relationships with and am servicing well to, you know, refer me into different businesses, talking to new business owners, trying to get an opportunity to, you know, talk to them about my expertise and why I think Alera Group would be a good fit for their company. And, you know, really a lot of it is having those conversations with people to see if it is a fit, because it's, you know, it's, I'm sure you're familiar with this. Like it's, I don't think that I'm the right solution for everybody, mm-hmm. you know? And that's okay. That's absolutely fine. But it's the opportunity to just have those conversations and see if I'm the right fit for, yeah. for somebody. So a lot of calling, talking to clients, answering emails. I try to get out of the office as much as I can, but I'm also someone who, when I'm in the office, I work well. And so mm-hmm. I know that I need to be here to get things done.
Yeah.
But a week can look like 4 days out on the road, visiting clients, going with our loss control team to, you know, do an evaluation for a new client or a new prospect or a current client, you know, taking people out for lunch, for golf, mm-hmm. you know, different things like that. Or it could be 5 days a week right here in my desk doing work mm-hmm. on the computer.
It sounds like you like to build relationships with your clients.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's the key to just about, I would say, any sales role. I'm a big relational person. You know, I want people to have trust in me and build trust in me. And I know that that's not something that just happens like that. And so, you know, when I build relationships with people, I want them to feel like they can call me or shoot mm-hmm. me a text. You know, I don't want to be someone who's on 24/7. You know, my wife will tell you firsthand that she doesn't love when I'm taking emails and phone calls on mm-hmm. vacation. So, but there's this part of me that honestly doesn't mind it. Like mm-hmm. it's not hard for me to do it. I don't feel like it's draining me all the time. Do I understand there's a time and place to say, okay, I'm not taking any work calls or texts mm-hmm. or anything. Absolutely.
Sure.
But you know, when it comes to building relationships with people, I think something I've learned is responsiveness and communication is key in any relationship. And so that's something that I try to do really well in the relationships I've built.
How often would you say on average you touch base with a client throughout a year? Is it several times a year? Is it kind of once or twice? Or does it really depend on the client?
It's highly dependent on the client and their how much they need to communicate with me. Mm-hmm. So my clients that require, you know, if they're a larger client, they're doing more complex projects, they need more, you know, they're getting asked to provide this type of insurance or this endorsement language on the policy, or they want us to do a contract review, you know, mm-hmm. it can be 2-3 times a month that I'm in touch with that client. But then I have clients that are, you know, they're a little bit more simplistic. They don't love talking to their insurance agent because, like you said, their eyes can glaze over. And, you know, it's maybe 2-3 times a year that I only touch base with them.
Mm-hmm. But there's a relationship formed. And I love that because in my experience, you know, I've had lots of different insurance coverages over the years with my business entities. And I haven't had that level of relationship with an agent. And maybe that's on me as a business owner. Maybe my needs have been very simple, and they have. So no knock against the agent, but I love that relationship, because I think especially in our industry, having somebody who you really know and trust and who's there on your side is so critical and just such an important part of our business.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that.
So let's get into some of the snow specific things. What is going on with snow coverage, coverage and our insurance coverage in the snow industry, I should say, to be more specific. It seems like there's some changes happening, some yeah. shifts. So kind of walk us through some of those things that are kind of more recent and you know, what contractors should be understanding about insurance coverage.
Yeah. So, Phil, I'm going to ask you to make sure you ask me to explain anything that's not in language that you think
I will do so.
Yeah, because I can get into the weeds here. So to keep it as simple as possible, insurance companies do not like snow removal, right? It's an area.
Wonderful.
That, yeah. Like I'll be straightforward with it. They don't love it. It's an area that it's a big spend for them when claims do come in. However, we are starting, my focus has been on this industry for about the past 4.5 years now. We are starting to see some changes in how they view snow contractors. A big part of it comes down to what type of story your agent is telling to the carrier, how they're selling your account to the insurance marketplace, right? I think in general, and we talked about this at Snow Alliance a little bit, in general, the insurance industry sees a lot of these snow removal companies as, you know, your Joe Schmo who's slapping a plow on the front of his truck or the back of their, an assaulter on the back of their truck, you know, to just keep bringing in some money throughout the winter months. Mm-hmm. And they're just going out there and taking any job that they can. And so I would say that overall, that's the general idea that insurance companies and underwriters have when they see snow removal. And so having gotten to know some clients and prospects in this realm, like that couldn't be further from the truth. You know, you guys, they take snow removal extremely seriously. Like it is something that you're planning for annually, year round. You're having snow rodeos. There's constant conversations going on in the summer months that are about how you can do things better, how you can be more proactive, what you can do to, you know, improve a site plan and where you're going to push snow next year and where you can dump snow and all of these different things. And so one of the things that I've really hit some strides with the insurance market in the recent years is helping them to see insurance risks, these clients that I'm bringing to them, in a different light, right? It's not just the Joe Schmo with a plow and a salter on the back of the truck. These are companies that take this seriously. And so therefore, you know, it's worth listening to their story a little bit more.
That's just crazy. If I could just hop in real quick, it's crazy for me to think that the insurance market has no clue about what level of investment has been made in the professional snow and ice industry in terms of equipment and technology and sophistication of weather modeling and decision-making criteria and, you know, software and cameras and weather data. Just it's incredible to think that, you know, somebody other than maybe, you know, my parents who are in their 80s has this perception of your typical snow contractor is just the Joe Schmo in a truck. That just kind of blows my mind.
Yeah. And I think a big part of it, to, you know, just be honest with you, is it comes down to the fact that there's not a real, like, insurance companies will build specialty segments that they want to focus on. Snow and ice removal is never one of them. Right. And so they've never felt the need that they have to get nitty gritty with it and understand.
Is that because it's a real unprofitable and they just, it's a hard thing to make profitable for them? So they're not looking for more of that work.
Yeah. Okay. There's a volatility to it. Like there's accounts that I have that have been extremely profitable, you know, for the carriers. 100%. They've been making profit and money off of their premiums. But then there's also the chance of, you have two bad years of slip and falls and all of a sudden you're in the hole $500,000 sure. on that. And so that's where a lot of it comes from. It's just not been a focus. So insurance companies haven't set aside, you know, hey, we want to go and have two of our underwriters specialize and focus on this segment and learn it really well. And that's why it comes down to so much making sure you are sharing everything that you're doing with your insurance agent and making sure that your insurance agent, that they know how to sell your account to the marketplace so that they're painting you in the best picture for this insurance company, whether it be whoever it is that they're taking your account to, that they see you in a, you know, in the best light to want to offer a quote for your business.
How do you do that? How do you take your knowledge of a contractor and retell that story on the contractor's behalf to the insurance marketplace? How does that work? Is that just because of relationships you have, or is there some, like, I'm just thinking, like, how do you get that story out?
I mean, it definitely starts with relationships. It has to be something where the client or the prospect is willing to be honest with you about what they do, how they do it, how serious they take it. You know, I can only share with the carrier what my client or prospect shares with me. Mm-hmm. And so I have to ask the right questions, and I trust that my clients and prospects are giving me honest answers. And from there, you know, going to the insurance carrier and talking to them, I can tell you the biggest thing that we're having conversations with carriers with is how they're rating it. When I started working on this class of business, it was primarily you're being rated based off of your total sales. And okay. So if you're a 5 million, if you do 5 million in total sales as a snow contractor, that was what they were applying your exposure to on the general liability. And that meant that
for snow revenue only or all revenue from all services?
Snow revenue only. Speaking to snow revenue only here. If you had a landscaper, if you're a landscaper and have snow, they do get separately classified, yes. Mm-hmm. But speaking to snow specifically here.
Okay.
So if you just say 5 million in annual snow sales, that's what they're putting down as your exposure. And then that means that for every $1,000 in snow sales, you're being charged a rate on your general liability. Well, in talking with a lot of my clients and prospects, you come to find out that they're structuring their contracts to be guaranteed cost contracts, where they're selling essentially, honestly, the way they describe it to me is that they're selling an insurance policy mm-hmm. to their client saying, hey, whether sure. it's an inch or up to whatever increment they have set to, mm-hmm. you know, start earning additional on top of, whatever it snows to where that mark is set, we're coming out and we're doing the job for $500,000 for your site.
Or and some hybrid model where there's retainers, but right. there's your point is there's guaranteed revenue,
there's
whether
guaranteed
it snows,
revenue.
Whether they're working or not.
Precisely. Yeah. And so I recognize there's a huge gap here because the insurance companies, this is like, they're calling this the exposure, which is what they're exposed mm-hmm. to potentially having a claim come in from. And there's a gap because, okay, they're making $5 million in total sales, but that doesn't mean that that's their true exposure because mm-hmm. they were making $500,000 on this contract and it may have only snowed 20 inches total throughout the entire winter. What we're starting to see carriers be willing to do is underwrite it based off of payroll. Because that okay. is that's a much, much, much more accurate picture of your exposure mm-hmm. because that tells
for
them
sure.
this is what they actually are doing in snow mm-hmm. removal. This is how much they're
perfect.
Actually performing as opposed to just the total number of sales that you have. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen some of the carriers come around to being willing to rate it based off of that exposure as to payroll compared to sales. And it's a massive differentiator when it comes to your general liability premiums.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's great. What wonderful insight and totally makes sense when you think about it. But again, it kind of speaks to the ignorance of the insurance market, not knowing our industry and having an agent that can explain this
yeah.
and fight for the client is huge. So that's happening on your side. Like, you're the professional, you're advocating for your client to the insurance market. What can contractors be looking at with their own internal operations? I know we always talk about documentation and we can, maybe there's some specific things that you can talk about if you want to in terms of documentation, but are there other kind of gaps or holes that contractors would do well to kind of shore up? Especially over the summer here, you know, we're recording this session here today in May. Contractors have the whole summer and fall to maybe address some of the holes that they have in their operation. So are there any things that come to mind?
Yeah, I won't beat the horse of documentation too much here. I think people, especially in this industry, they know that documentation is key when it comes to litigation and fighting and defending claims. I believe you had Josh Ferguson on last episode, and he talks about that a lot. But when it comes to looking at gaps and what they can shore up in operations, you know, one of the things that I would say I'm learning is you can be a super clean, well-organized, well-run snow contractor doing all of the right things. If you're doing sites that insurance carriers don't like, that is a huge red flag to them. And sometimes it's the deal breaker of being able to get an account written. Now, this being said, I also understand the gas stations, the strip malls, the Walmarts, the Lowe's, the Home Depots, they need service. I totally understand that. But I would say the biggest piece of advice I give to many of my clients is choose the clients you're going to service wisely. A lot of these things, like this, the accounts that I just mentioned, from an insurability standpoint, if I take an account to market and I say, hey, here's a list of their accounts and clients that they service, and they got, you know, 40 gas stations on there, they're not going to want to insure it, because they're going to say it's the likelihood. Yes, Matt, we understand they're doing all these things right, but the likelihood that someone's going to slip and fall and put a claim in here just because fortunate nature of our society, what we're living in today, that it's too high for us to put our name behind it. So, and I get it when you're starting out, or if that's the niche that you've built, I understand that that might be what you're doing.
But so high traffic retail sites, like a gas station, especially after hours, still a lot of traffic.
24/7.
People go to the gas station to get munchies after they've been drinking, and there's all kinds of liability there. Whereas something else that might be considered retail, like a local bank, like there's no traffic. So, right. So that might be a completely different thing than a gas station. So you really can't just broad stroke say all retail is bad.
Right.
From an insurance perspective, it's really more nuanced than that. Right.
Absolutely. And that's, again, this just goes back to the conversation piece with your agent of, you know, if you're, they'll send you an application and just don't, you know, if they're just sending you an application and it says retail and you're putting, you know, 10 retail sites, and then there's no, you know, there's no additional conversation about that, that's a problem for you, because you need to know, okay, what are these retail sites? Because to your point, like you just said, a bank is an entirely different risk to an underwriter compared to a, you know, a Walmart. That's a totally different beast. And so that's where the difference comes in, and having those conversations is critical.
Yeah. So let's talk about slip and fall. So inevitably, you know, we're going to have some claims if we're in the industry long enough. I actually had a crazy situation happen early in my career. I saw this woman walking across a sidewalk. She looked around to kind of case the situation and see what was going on. She sat down and started screaming. And of course, I had to respond. Responded to this woman, you know, asked all the right questions, filled out all the paperwork, you know, that my company required me to fill out as far as, you know, documenting the situation and getting her statement and taking a photo and making a sketch. And I did all the things, right? And then I found out that same day she had a check in her hand. She was paid out the exact same day. And I don't know what the amount was, but I was so mad. I was so frustrated because I literally saw this woman just sit down and start screaming bloody murder and said she fell and hurt herself and blah, blah, blah. So what's going on there? Like, walk us through how that happens and what contractors can do about it, if anything, or is it just the nature of the beast?
Yeah, it's the unfortunate part of this industry. I would say with the increase in camera footage today that's available, that's one way to, like, for example, in I don't know if in your instance there was camera footage.
There was not.
Okay. No, right. So
I think, that would have been great.
I think camera footage is critical right now in this industry. You know, forward facing, rear facing, driver facing cameras. You know, people, I think they're really hesitant when they hear that. But truthfully, the reason the insurance companies, if they're asking you to put them in place or if you'd consider putting them in place, is because it helps to fight these claims that come in like this. These, you know, we'll call them bogus claims that come in. If there's cameras on a site or there's cameras on a truck and you can show that, hey, this person is saying that, you know, we rear-ended them doing 30 miles an hour, and then you have a camera that shows like, no, they swerved right in front of you at a stop sign and you bumped them at 10 miles an hour, 15 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. It's huge when it comes to an insurance carrier's ability to fight the claim, because unfortunately, and Josh kind of addressed this in some of his conversations with you, the personal injury attorneys and the litigious society that we're in today, it's not shifting in favor towards business owners. It's shifting in favor towards the plaintiffs, right? People that are claiming this, and juries are much more sympathetic towards a individual than they are towards the picture that an attorney paints, you know, the big bad company,
mm-hmm. you know, right,
or whatever.
Well, let's say it's not a bogus claim. Let's say someone really slipped and fell and they really did hurt themselves, and there is a legitimate claim. And then there's a decision about what do we do? How are we settling this? How much are we settling it for? Are we going to fight this? Are we going to take the position that we did, you know, we performed our services according to industry standards, and, you know, I'm sorry you fell down and hurt yourself, but you were also, you know, maybe not wearing boots or whatever, right?
Yeah, slippers.
So walk me through the decision-making process that occurs when a claim comes in, and what, you know, what involvement could a contractor have in that decision-making process, or have they given up all their rights to be involved in that decision-making process once they've, you know, paid the premium and obtain the coverage? Yeah. Or is that negotiable?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah, I'll answer the latter part of your question first. And people don't like to hear this. So you can definitely be involved in the conversation. Like you're a paying customer to the insurance agent, mm-hmm. or to the insurance carrier. You have every right to be involved in the conversations with the adjusters and their claims team on what happened and your thoughts on it. But ultimately, you don't have the decision. The decision doesn't lie in your court. And insurance companies are in the business of making money, right? Mm-hmm. They're just like any other business. They want to be profitable. They have a duty to be profitable. And so they look at everything from a profitability standpoint and from a insurance spend standpoint. Like, what is this going to cost us? Mm-hmm. And that's why you often see settlements happening, because if they settle, they don't have to defend you in court. And there's also not the chance that not only are they paying for your defense, but then there's still the chance that the jury decides that they need to pay out to the plaintiff.
Sure. Right?
And right. So the spend's big. So, and what I've come to really appreciate, and this is something I talk to the insurance companies about when I'm speaking, is I understand why these snow and ice contractors, they feel like this is such a hit to them personally, because you guys take such pride in the services that you provide to people and how you do it. And when the insurance carrier doesn't go to bat for you, it feels like it like this, the loss run shows that the slip and fall claim occurred. And to the snow contractor, it feels like this ding on their resume of like,
right,
you didn't do quality work. You didn't right. do something well. And what I try to tell them is that that's never the actual case. Just because there's slip and falls claims on your policy, it doesn't mean that you are a bad snow and ice contractor, right? The insurance companies are going to make a financial decision on this, mm-hmm. based off of, and it's all dependent on the areas you're located in, right? If they know that the the courtrooms and the juries in one portion of a state are in more favor and they're not as, you know, quick to give out payment, they're going to fight it more. Whereas if you're in a different area and they know, nope, it's probably not going to go in our favor, we're just going to try and settle this on the front steps of the courtroom. You know, that's where it kind of comes in. But, you know, when they, when their decision's coming up on how they want to fight this claim or whether they just want to settle immediately, that's where it's impossible to avoid talking about documentation. 100%, your best chance at fighting an insurance claim is if you're able to provide documentation, you know, going back to the original contract that you signed that lists the scopes of your purposes and what you're doing for the client, and your responsibilities are clearly outlined there. You know, time stamping, we arrived at 5 a.m. We applied X amount of salt. We, you know, left the site at 5:45 a.m., monitored site conditions, air temps, ground temps, et cetera, returned to the site at 8 p.m. that night because air temps and ground temps plummeted. So we wanted to focus on the refreeze, came out and applied additional salt, time stamping, all of this stuff. Like, the more documentation you can show to show that, you know, you did your job to the best absolute possible or to the best of your capabilities. If you can give that to a carrier and a claims adjuster, they're going to be much, much more willing to say, all right, we need to think this one through and see if this is something we want to fight harder for our client.
Yeah, you're just reinforcing all those things that you had referenced, the Josh Ferguson podcast episode that I recorded recently. And Josh talks a lot about evidence and having, you know, quality evidence. So I would encourage people to go back and listen to that episode and get some more detail about some of that. But you just reinforced all that. And it's and it's worth thinking about, because the quality of that evidence and that documentation is going to probably impact the amount of the settlement, right?
Yes. Yeah. And it's never to say that they're not going to pay out still, but it could, it definitely can dictate the amount of the settlement.
Right. Right. And going back to your other point about juries, you know, juries in general are always, not just in general, but every jury is unpredictable. You never know. You can't anticipate what a jury's, judges are actually, you know, if there's no jury, if you just have a bench trial and you're in front of a judge, judges are somewhat predictable because they have a history of making decisions, and judges have to defend their decisions. So there's a trail of cases, a body of work that the judge has that's on record. That's not the case with a jury. A jury is a random selection. So, and I would assume most juries probably are going to fall more or be more favorable toward the injured party, whether their person's really injured or not, versus the company, the big bad company with all the money, right?
Correct.
So the last thing you want to do is end up in court, I think. And I think Josh would probably say the same thing.
100%.
What other advice do you have for snow contractors? We probably have a couple more minutes here. Anything else stand out to you that you would want to get out on this podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it would be really bad if I didn't mention that there's an area of insurance that some clients have to go to, and it's called the excess and surplus marketplace.
Ah, okay. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So that's just basically the excess and surplus marketplace is the non-admitted carriers. And the 1,000-foot overview of this is the standard market, your admitted carriers, think of like your Travelers, the Hartford, Liberty Mutual, these different carriers, they file their forms and their rates with the State Department of Insurance every year. And so they are admitted, and they are also then backed by the state's, essentially like a state bonding program or state guarantee. Okay. That then dictates the forms that they provide. So they can't exclude certain things from their forms. And it dictates what their rating structure can look like. This was actually a big part of the issue out in California a few years back with the wildfires. Okay. Mm-hmm. The excess and surplus market, which is where if you are a true snow and ice contractor, meaning you have no green exposure, you don't have any landscaping, you're not doing excavation, you're not doing site work, you're just a true snow and ice contractor operating in, you know, November through March, that's it. Likelihood is you're in the excess and surplus marketplace. And the reason that you go there is because it's the only place you can get insurance. And when they're non-admitted in this place, it just means they're not backed by the state's guarantee. And their forms, they get to dictate what can be included and excluded on the form of coverage. Mm. And they also get to dictate the rates that they provide so that they can be more profitable in it. And that's the main reason the excess and surplus marketplace exists. So one of the things that I would say, if you're someone in the excess and surplus marketplace, to be really, really weary of is, number one, it's definitely going to cost you more. And in this space, when you get audited, if you're on a minimum or if you're on a guaranteed cost policy, which many of these excess and surplus carriers, they put a guaranteed cost or a minimum premium on the policy. You are not going to get anything back at an audit. And so what that means is the excess and surplus market also usually rates you based off of your sales. They won't give you the opportunity to be rated off of payroll. And so that's already strike number one against you. Mm-hmm. But number two, if you give them say $5 million in sales and then you end up only doing 3.5 or 4 million and you paid as if you were going to do five, tough. Your minimum mm-hmm. premium is met. You're not wow. getting that additional premium back. But, and this is where I understand people's, I totally get why they hate insurance. If you do $6 million in sales, they're going to come and collect the premium.
Oh, I like how that works.
Yeah. Okay. So where it's critical for people in the snow and ice space to know this is, make sure that you're asking your agent, okay, am I in the standard market or the excess and surplus market? How is my rating being structured? Is it on sales or is it on payroll? Mm-hmm. And if you know that it's on sales and you're in the excess and surplus marketplace, ask them what's the minimum premium for this policy and what are we using as my rate, as my exposure? Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to end up being, you know, having less in sales and then not getting that money back. I'd rather know my rate so that way I can plan throughout the year so that if I do exceed my exposure of say 5 million, I can then say, okay, we're going to be above 5 million, but I know my rate. I know it's per $1,000 of sales. And so then I know what I can expect when the audit comes in. As opposed to you thinking, oh, well, we only ran 3.5 million. We should be seeing something returned to us. And it just doesn't happen. So when you're in that space, the best thing to do is speak with your agent and make sure you're being a little bit more conservative on your total sale amount mm-hmm. so that you're not just paying for something that you don't use all of.
Yeah. Well, my thought, in addition to everything you just said, my thought also jumps to kind of business structure and strategic planning and formation of your entities. You know, a lot of people want to have their snow business in a separate legal entity from their summer business, whatever that is. And so to think through the structure and who's buying the insurance and is there a corporate entity, umbrella entity that's purchasing the insurance and it seems to me there's a bigger conversation about how all that needs to work. And man, to have somebody like you on my team would be huge that can advise me and help me understand that so I don't make decisions with my business model that really come back to bite me later.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something we talk about often in this space is do you want to have a separate entity and not put your entire business at risk of being dropped or having, you know, one claim affect everything? You know, if you keep it combined and you're higher on the landscape side, which generally, if you're doing both, you usually are, if you're a 60-40 landscaper to snow, you know, could we get your snow insurance covered under the standard market the likelihood if they like the sites that you're performing on and they like your contract structure and all these things, yes. But it then puts your entire company at risk for losses. Mm-hmm. Whereas, sure, like you said, if we want to separate it, it's gonna cost you more, but then only the snow portion of this is affected.
Yeah. So there's a cost risk reward, cost benefit risk reward analysis that has to occur. Yep. So let's go ahead and wrap it up there, Matt. This has been fantastic. I do want to ask though, how can someone get a hold of you if they want to chat and find out more about your services and potentially get some pricing from you?
Yeah.
What's the best way to reach you?
LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn. There's not a lot of Del Borellos in the United States. It's a unique Italian last name. So if you just go on LinkedIn, search Matthew Del Borello, I'm active on LinkedIn. So you can catch me on there.
Great.
And if I tried to spell out my email, it's literally Matthew.Delborello at Alera Group. It's too long.
And spell your last name for us.
Yeah, it's DelBorrello.
Two R's and two L's.
Two R's and two L's, correct.
Beautiful. All right, awesome. So you're a regular attendee at Snow Alliance at Storks. Anywhere else that we might be able to bump into you?
Yeah, I'm involved in a couple different builders associations, constructions associations here local to the Lehigh Valley, up in the Poconos, Lehigh Valley Builders. Part of ABC, Associated Builders and Contractors for Eastern PA. Looking to get involved in a couple of the national like landscape conventions, things like that, that we've seen to get in front of some people. So you might see us at that. And well, I can't be at SIMA this year. We have attended SIMA in the past when it was in Pittsburgh 2 years ago.
Yeah, for sure.
So we've been out to SIMA. And so just have a trip planned this year that runs at the same point as SIMA, so won't be there this year. But that's something also that we look to be at each year.
Well, you also have a 2-month-old at home, so. Matt, thanks you again. Thanks again for being here. This has been amazing. Good information. I actually learned some things. I tried to approach this as if I was completely ignorant, but I learned some things. So, as I always do. So, thank you again. We appreciate you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Phil. It was an honor, and really enjoyed the time.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Snow Fighters Institute podcast. Subscribe so you don't miss future episodes and check out our upcoming events at snowfightersinstitute.com.